This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm going to throw you a softball, which is, and I recommend, you can see I've marked up mine, why the focus on history? And you spend a fair amount of time. Clearly, someone was doing a lot of research into how the Supreme Court, why?
Well, first of all, let me start by saying what a thrill it is for me to be with you, who my old friend, somebody I admire so much for all you have done and do, and how excited I am to hear about the Democracy Policy Initiative. This is absolutely what's needed all over the country, and it makes a ton of sense that here at Berkeley you're pioneering it. We really believe we're in a great fight for the future of American democracy, that the stakes are that high, and this kind of engagement is really critical to it. The history tells us a lot about this moment in the Supreme Court, because we've been, in some respects, in fights like this before. We've been in moments like this before. It can be a bit of a booby trap, because I don't think we should be governed solely by history. And when we talk about the Supreme Court and originalism, it can be easy to get all caught up in that. But I think when we look at the moment we're in now, where the Supreme Court has, in my view, veered off course, and there is, at the very least, the beginning of a robust backlash, that has happened before, and it's worth knowing how it happened and how the court got to its position of power today.
Well, in reading, there are instances in which, for a long time, the Supreme Court was held, as Professor Brady said, sort of in esteem, with respect, with trust. But you've outlined situations that where the court was, candidates were running against the Supreme Court. Someone like Teddy Roosevelt. Why?
It was, you know, the Supreme Court only attained the position, not even of equality necessarily, but being a super legislature over the other branches of government over time. And the Constitution, the part of the Constitution that deals with the federal courts and the Supreme Court, is only 1/10 the length of the parts dealing with the presidency and Congress, these more democratically accountable branches. The court only gained this role by getting the credibility with the public. And one of the things that's noteworthy when you look at it throughout history is it largely reflected the political consensus of the country at almost all the time it's been around, at least the political consensus of the elite of the country. It's sort of, the Supreme Court hugged the middle. But there were a few times where it was unduly partisan or extremist or activist. And when that happened, and it was only a few times, there was a ferocious backlash. And it was not just a backlash by lawyers and judges and people with footnotes, but voters, people marching in the streets, political parties. So the first time was in the late 1850s, the Dred Scott decision, which, you know, folks know that decision, but it was at a time of agitation, rising opposition to slavery and the spread of slavery, and the Supreme Court felt, well, we were going to try to, quote, solve the problem, by which they meant the problem of people agitating about slavery. And this was the opinion where they said that slavery could not be barred by Congress from the territories. In other words, it could not be contained in the South. It was national. And worse than that, that black people could not be citizens. And this was extraordinarily controversial. It was, by the way, also not just only the second time the Supreme Court struck down a law passed by Congress. The first was Marbury versus Madison. It was also the very first big Supreme Court opinion to leak. It didn't leak to Politico. It leaked to the incoming president, James Buchanan, who wanted them to do this. And he kind of finagled and got them to go big with this ruling. And then he got up and gave his inaugural address and said, "We all know that the Supreme Court is going to make a big ruling on slavery. None of us know what it's going to say, but let's all just agree. Whatever they say, we're going to go along with it, right?" And everybody said, "Oh, now we know." And it was fiercely opposed. It led to the rise of the Republican Party. Abraham Lincoln's election to the presidency was much about the Dred Scott case. And ultimately, the Civil War, and the end of slavery. The second period where this same phenomenon of overreach and backlash happened in a big way was, as you said, at the beginning of the 20th century when the country was very much like now. There was economic change, massive inequality, demographic change, and the Supreme Court of that time felt that their job, the elitos of that court, felt that their job was to stop government from doing anything about it, to use constitutional theories to stop government from protecting workers' rights, taxes and antitrust and worker protections. And it was, again, hugely controversial, not just in an abstract way, but Teddy Roosevelt, as you mentioned, his 1912 presidential campaign, I didn't know this till researching for this, which was when he ran as a third-party candidate, and it was this epic race where he ran against Taft, who had been his handpicked successor, and Woodrow Wilson was the Democrat, and there was a socialist candidate. Teddy Roosevelt's big issue was taking on the Supreme Court for cases like Lochner and other cases because of its reactionary rulings. He had some very dramatic proposals. He didn't win, but it was what people fought about. It was what people voted about and organized about, all leading up to, you know, his cousin Franklin Roosevelt's war with the court on the same issues. You don't want to get in the way of those Roosevelts. In the 1930s, it didn't just start during the New Deal. And then the third period, I would say, and this is a little, we'll agree that Justice Brennan and Chief Justice Warren will give us a pass to talk about this, was the period when, of the Warren Court, and especially the aftermath of the Warren Court, which I regard as the greatest period of the Supreme Court in the sense that I think that rulings were so extraordinarily valuable and important, starting with Brown v. Board of Education. But over time, they came so fast and so furious and engendered their own backlash. And we are living in that backlash to this day, which brought us to this point. So to me, the history is not just of academic or creative interest, but it actually tells us how we got here and how there were other times like this.
And that there are ways, potentially, for responding. But I want to probe a little. I had the occasion a few years back to teach a course with Professor Jonathan Simon on morally complex issues and the law. And one of the things that we were looking at is why in this country some of these really difficult issues like abortion, the right to abortion, or the death penalty, or immigration, or why we, the Supreme Court, whereas in other countries those might be more a result of political action. And so were we asking the court too much?
It's a great question. Look, I think some of this is baked into the structure of our system in the sense that we have a written constitution. Great Britain, for example, to this day does not. And it was a very unusual thing and a new thing to have a written constitution. We also, de Tocqueville, when he came to the United States in the 1830s, and he was both intrigued by and thrilled by this very bumptious new democracy, but also kind of terrified of the kind of excesses that he felt could come. And he said, you know, in Europe, where he was from, we have the masses, but we also have the aristocracy in between the public and the king. Here there's no aristocracy, so lawyers are the aristocracy. And Thomas Paine in Common Sense said, here the law is king. So from the beginning, we sort of embraced ideologically this idea that it's not, those founding documents, when you go, of course, to the National Archives, it's kind of like a religious experience to see them there. But I also think it is a more recent and more potentially misguided phenomenon too, especially among progressives, especially among liberals, those of us who look to the court to ride in and save the day. That is, to a certain extent, a function, I think, of this period in the mid-20th century, and it was a really limited period, where the court, for the only time, was ahead of the country on advancing equality and promoting rights. Usually the courts kind of protect property and are a small-c conservative force, but that was not, you know, so much the case then. And there was a generation of people who grew used to the idea that when there was a social problem to be addressed, you would go to court, and that would be a remedy or a routine or a solution. And that is a glow that has lingered on now more than half a century since the Supreme Court, even if it was true back then, it's been half a century, but we still kind of have that hazy glow in our minds.
Well, I'm hearing a glimmering of we should blame our current state on the fact that lawyers kept litigating important issues. Is that what?
One of the things that happened, I mean, I think that's a little bit true in the sense that the reaction to that period on the right, they organized. They worked to win in the court of public opinion. I wrote a book on the history of the Second Amendment, and they spent decades, the NRA spent decades trying to change what people saw the Second Amendment meant. The result of Roe v. Wade was similarly to spur eventually a very robust grassroots political movement against abortion rights. And those who support abortion rights, those of us, I would count myself in this number, who believe in reproductive freedom as we see it, relied to a certain extent on the courts to be the bulwark, and lost a muscle memory of how to really do real politics. And this, it's, you know, this is something interestingly that people, including Barack Obama, when he was a young law professor, talked about this. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is not gone unnoticed, but it is something that I think people got very used to.
Well, you write that in addition to sort of the litigation, is that the discourse on the liberal side became one focused on rights. And it seemed to me that, well, when we talk about rights, they're sort of individual rights. And you say, instead of looking at social systems or equality, so two-part question. One, is that focus on rights now got us to this, like, cul-de-sac, there's no way out? And where is the, where can we, what's the intellectual capital? What's the theory framework?
Yeah. I do think that there's some truth to that. And I think, one, first of all, for starters, when you think about rights, that means it's something that really adheres to more or less to an individual. And that we think, oh, you go to court to you know, to get somebody to uphold your rights. But if the remedy that really makes a difference is redistribution, economic redistribution, or structural change on antitrust or other things about the structure of the economy, a bit of a lost tradition of American progressivism and social action, it's just never going to be particularly doable by pursuing rights in the courts. And there are a number of wonderful young scholars who are making these arguments now. Nico Bowie and Jamal Green and others who don't have the received glow of the Warren Court era quite as much. But I also think, and it's also worth noting that in the half century since that heyday, rights have been used and in some ways co-opted by very reactionary forces. The most significant use of rights very often now is the striking down of our campaign finance laws using a First Amendment rationale, the poking of numerous holes in the human rights laws and equality laws pertaining to LGBTQ rights, claiming religious freedom. In other words, rights can be used for all different kinds of stuff. So the thornier side of the question, we talked about this a little bit before, is you know, you can't beat something with nothing. And there's a lot of emotional power to talking about rights. There's a lot of emotional power to talking about the original meaning of the Constitution and originalism and the kind of reverence for the framers and their wisdom, those documents in the religious aura of the National Archives. And this is something, too, I think, where those who are not sympathetic to the Federalist Society's vision of the Constitution have been silent and have not done the work of framing an alternative to their approach. I mean, there was a time when Justice Brennan talked about the living Constitution, and people came to think that was a little too loosey-goosey, that it didn't have enough of a framework. And the ideas of the right now are sort of all still in reaction to that. And they're saying, well, we're being originalists. There's no conservative There's no political content to it at all. We just want to have a fixed point in time. It's just a coincidence that we're saying the social views of property-owning white men from the 1700s should govern our country now. But it to me, there is, at this moment, there is no coherent and publicly accessible, not just to lawyers, but to people, the voters, way of talking about the Constitution, about democracy, and about the structure we want that can do battle. When you listen to the hearings for confirmation for judges, Supreme Court justices, but not just them, all the judges, to me it's kind of painful because the Judiciary Committee, which we all sometimes watch, the Republicans say to judges who are nominated, are you now or have you ever been a living constitutionalists? Do you believe in originalism? Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said, I pledge to only enforce those rights that are deeply rooted in history and tradition. It's kind of a blunt instrument, but they're making a philosophical argument. And the Democrats say, tell us about your family. Did you love your parents? Did they give you lessons in hard work that you want to share with them? There's no, and they affirmatively duck jousting with the Republicans on philosophy. And I do think that's a mistake.
Well, before we get to now and how we got here, you've highlighted the court, the sort of veneration or reverence for the law. But we use that belief in the rule of law not just to help sort of manage things, peaceful transfer of power until January 6, 2021. But how can you figure out a way that we still respect the law when we disagree, but also when, if you throw it out and say it is...
It's all just politics. And,
right. Aren't we at risk of losing something very, very important?
I think one of the challenges is to maintain and uphold the reverence for the rule of law and the ideals of the Constitution without fetishizing the Supreme Court as the body that will tell us all what to do. I mean, it is an unusual thing that we sit around every June and wait to find out what country we're going to live in. The book talks about the first full year of this supermajority of the six very conservative justices sort of moving largely in lockstep. And then in 3 days, they did the Dobbs case, which, as you know, was overturned Roe v. Wade and half a century of federal constitutional protections for reproductive rights, but also did so in a way that really put at risk all the other privacy rights in the Constitution. The day before that was the Bruin case, which was by far the most extreme Second Amendment ruling in the country's history. And the day after that was the case of West Virginia versus EPA, which is less dramatic and vivid in some ways than guns or abortion, but with the beginning in a significant way, it was about climate change, but it was the beginning of a constitutional assault on the ability of government to protect the environment, to protect the public, regulatory agencies, all in 3 days. A decade's worth of social change in 3 days. And when you think of the topics also, for the first 2 years of this supermajority, guns, abortion, affirmative action, the interest of the fossil fuel industry, that doesn't sound like a court. That sounds like a political caucus. And so I think that disentangling our reverence for the Constitution and the rule of law, which is vital to the country and deeply embedded in who we are, with this specific role of the Supreme Court, and especially this Supreme Court, is a challenge, but I think we have to find a way to do it.
So how we got here. And I think you've been in Washington. We were there at the beginning of the 24/7 news cycle.
There was one cable channel.
There was one cable channel, but then, so one criticism that is often leveled to the Democratic Party, including members of Congress, is that they so believe in government and aren't willing to go to the mat and sort of just throw a monkey wrench into the works. Whether it's a week out, I remember, we're confirming what people we're going to send up to serve on the bench. We try to find the moderates. We're not willing to go. I say we. So my question is, in this, how we got to this 6-3, norms were broken in ways that I like left most people sort of dumbfounded. It was like, no, you're not going to give Merrick Garland a hearing? And you're going to confirm Amy Coney Barrett in less than 45 days? Like, how do you respond to that? I mean, what were we missing? Are we just got caught? Like, people aren't going to do that. And then they did.
And, you know, I think that as people look at this moment politically, but even thinking also about what could happen in 2025, Democrats, and certainly the administration of which we were a part, were endlessly looking over their shoulder at what they thought the market, political market, would bear, what the swing voters would tolerate. And part of what Mitch McConnell taught us is most people aren't paying attention most of the time. And if you have something you want to do, do it. And don't break the law. But, you know, there was no law. I mean, it was absolutely mind-bogglingly unexpected and extraordinary that he did not give President Obama's nomination the chance to even be heard. But it also wasn't illegal. There was nothing that required it. And part of the lesson, it's an interesting thing. So one of the reasons, as you correctly note, the judges that were appointed by Democratic presidents before President Biden, including President Clinton, they were qualified. They were more diverse than the judges the Republicans appointed. But they were very cautious, and they were very often prosecutors or corporate lawyers, and they were not the leading intellectual lights of progressive law and that sort of thing. And one of the reasons was because they needed 60 votes in the Senate to break through the filibuster. And in recent years, they've ended the filibuster for judicial nominations, both for lower courts and the Supreme Court. And in a way, that is kind of smashing up the system. But it has also meant that a lot of the judges, on the one hand, you get ideologues, like the judges we're all learning about scattered all throughout the country ruling on some of these cases. But we also now have this administration said, we want voting rights lawyers, we want public defenders, we don't want the same old people. And so, in a sense, that was a willingness to break the norm. And it turned out it had some downsides, but it also has some upsides.
Well, here we are, about to have another election.
So I hear.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to escape it. And so the question, we are where we are. You did a terrific job of documenting the ways in which this court is enacting social policy. So the question going forward, you served on the Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court. What, reluctant to make recommendations or expand the court was one of the ones that was floating.
It was floating. It floated away. But part of what's happening, and I think this is really good, is that, again, we're in a period, I think, where there's a backlash to the court, and it's helping to shape our politics. And you see it in the response to Dobbs. You see it in all the ballot initiatives and constitutional amendments being passed all over the country. It was emphatically a big issue in the 2022 midterms. And I think also there needs to be a focus not just on the specific rulings, but on the court itself and on its role and the corruption that has enveloped it. And so that the easiest of these things, I think, should be a code of ethics. You know, we all learned about the Supreme Court, until quite recently, was the only court in the country without a code of ethics. Now it is the court with the weakest code of ethics. They issued something, they said, this is just to clear up, quote, the misunderstanding that there's a problem. But you know that what we're seeing with Clarence Thomas in particular and Harlan Crow, the right-wing billionaire who turns out to have subsidized his lifestyle for decades now, that is not they don't all do that. And it's really quite extraordinary. And it's not just he took a trip here or a steak dinner there. Thomas, Harlan Crowe bought Clarence Thomas's mother's house with her living in it and renovated it and paid for his surrogate son's education. If this was Albany, New York, or Springfield, or Illinois, or Sacramento, and it was some state senator with the local business person, we would all say, oh, we know what that is. That's just corruption, garden variety. But that's what we're facing. So that's kind of the easiest thing is an ethics
code. A code of ethics.
I think in the Brennan Center, which I lead, thinks as well, there needs to be something a lot more. I think there ought to be an 18-year term limit for Supreme Court justices. The basic premise is that nobody should have too much public power for too long. And in a sense, George Washington taught us that when he stepped down after two terms as president. And what's really interesting is it's actually, I learned this on this commission. So the commission was appointed by President Biden in 2021. And you know, these government commissions, they're sometimes set up to deflect action. And we were actually instructed at the outset not to reach conclusions publicly. And we didn't. It was a government agency that worked, you know, as intended. But what was so interesting is we heard from dozens of public witnesses from left and right, not just Democrats, conservatives, Republicans, independents. And they disagreed on so many things. Some were for court expansion, some were against. Some were for changing the jurisdiction of the court, some were against. Over and over again, they said, oh, but I'm for term limits, of course. There's actually, it's usually popular across party lines, poll after poll, and we've, at the Brennan Center, we've just done a bunch of public opinion research. It's actually, there's a strong majority for it in the country, sort of hiding in plain sight. Now, that doesn't mean it'll be some big group hug if it starts to move. We think you can do it not just by constitutional amendment, but by statute. You could make the justices become senior justices after 18 years, and it would really make a difference in bringing the court in line with the country they serve. They're staying on the court a lot longer than they ever did before.
Because they're being appointed at very, very young age. Well, that brings one sort of side question, because you made this point, and I certainly remember when Obama nominated Sonia Sotomayor. Very excited, but I actually, it's like, could you appoint a former AG, a governor? I was thinking Ken Salazar, for example, who became senator. Someone who has political experience, has run. So how, that notion that the only people who can be on the Supreme Court are people who go to the, you know, the three law schools, and are academics or former
right.
justices.
And right now, 8 of the 9 are former appellate federal court judges. And as you know, that is really unusual. It's this idea that it's this technical thing, that you need this technical expertise. And through most of the country's history, people who sat on the Supreme Court were former governors, secretaries of state, senators, a former president of the United States. And as you may remember, Bill Clinton, who went to, you know, fancy law school.
Yale,
as he may have mentioned. He was really ardently hoping to try to appoint a non-judge, to appoint, and he kept trying and it kept not working. He offered this Supreme Court seat twice to New York Governor Mario Cuomo, who he thought would have been eloquent and a kind of a match for Scalia. And Cuomo, as you know, had a reputation as sort of the Hamlet of the Hudson, they called him. He kind of dithered around and he finally said no twice. He tried to appoint George Mitchell, who had been a federal judge, who would have been great. He had been a federal judge and then was the Democratic leader of the Senate. And he tried to appoint Bruce Babbitt,
right.
And that's just the worst story of all. He was going to appoint Bruce Babbitt, who was the Interior Secretary and had been the governor of Arizona. But the environmental groups were fighting with the Western senators over who would be the replacement Interior Secretary. So they didn't appoint him. So, you know, I think they're missing a lot by not having people who've had to make arguments to the public, who've had to make compromise, who've had to lead institutions. The last elected official to be on the court was Sandra Day O'Connor. And actually, she was the Republican leader of the state Senate of Arizona. And you can see it in her jurisprudence. She crafted on affirmative action and on abortion rights these two rulings that at the time felt like kind of principle-free compromises, but actually were about finding the spot in the country where she could preserve those things with public support. And it actually, I think, had something to do with her strengths as a justice.
So we know the court is going to be hearing some pretty important cases. One of our audience questions, the Federal Circuit Court issued an opinion rejecting Trump's presidential immunity claim. A, do you think SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, is going to grant cert? And if so, where are your money?
So, it's interesting because they, as far to the right as they have veered, in my view, and as much of a political move as they are making, they kind of stayed out of Trump's troubles in the past. They did not bail him out on these kinds of things relating to his wrongdoing. They batted away the cases in 2020 that he brought to try to overturn the election. They upheld him having to comply with subpoenas and that sort of thing. They felt like, in a way, like they had a bigger project than bailing him out. They have no choice with some of these cases right now, but to engage. So this is one of the two big cases that, of course, are happening right at the same time and right as we meet. This relates to the prosecution, the federal prosecution, by the special counsel Jack Smith, of his effort to overthrow the Constitution and the peaceful transfer of power. The trial had been due to start March 4th, and Trump said, "Oh, I'm immune from prosecution," and he brought appealed basing this on the idea that a former president could not be prosecuted for acts he engaged in while in office. And it is an absurd argument. It is a legally easy case. It has been understood for most of the past century that while it was generally thought you couldn't prosecute a sitting president, of course you could prosecute a former president. Gerald Ford, when he pardoned Richard Nixon, the pardon said, he's about to be indicted and go on trial, and that's going to be really disruptive and bad, so therefore I'm pardoning him. And Nixon said, thank you, I'm about to be indicted and go on trial, so thank you for the pardon. It's always been understood that former presidents could be indicted, but because no former president ever had been indicted, the Supreme Court never ruled on it. So it's an easy case, but it's still a question of first impression. The D.C. Circuit, as you say, issued a very, very strong opinion saying that whatever the limits are on whether former presidents can be indicted, he can be for this. This was the rule. The argument in the court was one of the judges asked, could the president order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival and be immune from prosecution for that? And Trump's lawyer said, unless he had been impeached and removed by the Senate presumably hiding under their desks because SEAL Team 6 is coming after them, that yes, he cannot be prosecuted for that. And then this is one of the reasons it was particularly noteworthy that his reaction to the murder of Navalny in Russia was to say this is just like him. Literally a president murdering his political rival. So Trump lost. The Court of Appeals took its time. They could have ruled on this in about a day, but they waited a month or two and wrote a 58-page ruling. Now it's been appealed to the Supreme Court. We're waiting day by day and minute by minute. Will they take the case? I have no doubt that if they take the case, they will rule that he's not immune. But when are they going to do it? The key thing is the trial is frozen. There's a stay of the trial that the lower court judge issued. And if the Supreme Court says we're going to act really fast, but we're going to keep the stay in place, then they've given Trump a massive gift because it pushes the trial later and later in the year and makes it harder to do it. And so to me, they could reject. They could just say, we're not going to take the case. The lower court did a good job. We're not granting cert, as it's called. They could say, we're going to hear this case, but meanwhile, we're lifting the stay. You have your little trial. We're going to think these things through. The worst thing to me would be if they said, this is such an important matter, we're so wise and important, we need to really chew on it for a while. And that would be, even if they did a great ruling, it would be an absolute gift to Trump and his wrongdoing.
Well, and this question of stay, I mean, you describe sort of before Dobbs how the shadow docket worked, which I think supports the possibility that you want to explain that.
So the shadow docket is this really evocative name for something that has a long-standing history, which is the court making important decisions sometimes without hearing a full argument of a case. And they decide what cases to take, or sometimes they'll, if you think about them stopping an execution or something like that, or other things. It's called the motions practice, but increasingly it's been used on really big matters when they kind of don't want people to notice what they're doing. And so it's called the shadow docket. They use the shadow docket for ill. They allowed Texas, for example, to ban abortion a year ahead of their ruling on Dobbs and never made a ruling on it. They just used the shadow docket and said, you could go ahead and do that. We'll figure this out later. So they could make, that is the question, is it weird to make such a big ruling, like the president's
sort of
can be prosecuted, in a one paragraph order, or does that require eloquence and pompousness?
And accountability.
And accountability. You want them to actually
articulate the basis.
So this is where they could, they could, again, lift the stay, but say, we're going to hear this in normal order. And, of course, it comes at the same time as the other big case, which is the 14th Amendment case about what Colorado Supreme Court did. And there's a lot of conjecture that they're trying to craft a compromise that will encompass both cases.
And your prediction?
I think that's
what
they'll,
shouldn't be in that business, but...
The baseball great Yogi Berra said... it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. So we will do our best. As you know, that's the other big case. This was the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which was enacted in the wake of the Civil War as part of Reconstruction, has a provision that basically nobody had noticed for a long time that said that if you have sworn an oath and engaged in insurrection, you are not eligible to serve, and it lists a bunch of offices. And it does not actually say the president,
right?
But a lot of people would assume it would be weird to not include the president. And I think a lot of hopes have been poured into this case. I should start by saying I believe he's guilty. I believe it was an insurrection, and he engaged in the insurrection, and it was one of the worst things, perhaps the worst thing any president has ever done. The question is who makes the decision about that. And it was pretty clear from the argument. So the Colorado Supreme Court barred him from the ballot based on this. Other courts in other places have said otherwise. It's pretty clear from the argument at the Supreme Court that there are probably 8 and maybe 9 votes to overturn what the Colorado Supreme Court did. And Justice Kagan sort of said, look, whether this is a good idea or not, you really can't have one state making this decision for the whole country. This is the kind of thing Congress should pass a law about or something like that. If that is true, that is what they're going to do, then a lot of people think that John Roberts, who is certainly well aware that the credibility of the court has collapsed to the lowest level ever recorded in poll after poll, that they would be, if it's true that they're going to rule nearly unanimously that way and that Trump can be prosecuted, would be in their interest to kind of do it at the same time. And then everyone would say, we love them again. they're so wise. But they have to juggle the timing of these things. One can assume they're thinking about this.
You alluded to a recommendation from the Brennan Center. And I know we've got a few minutes left. And in our earlier conversations, we can't get despondent. We have to think about the future. And you referenced the, maybe 18-year term. What else can be done? And you mentioned, and the reason I'm asking in particular, sort of in a college setting, is climate change is on people's minds. And the Gen Z, but older people like us are also deeply concerned about climate change. And that EPA case and another couple of cases that are pending. So how do you build, how do you organize around, like Teddy Roosevelt did, given the issues, the dismantling, in essence, of the administrative state and what that means for efforts in this country on climate change?
It's a great question, because you're exactly right. That so this case that I mentioned from 2022, that was just the first one of these cases. And what they said in that case was that even if the Congress had passed a law, in that case the Clean Air Act, that gave the EPA the right to do this rule on climate change, it was just too big an issue, and so they couldn't do it. And they, for the first time, unveiled something they called the Major Questions Doctrine. And they were very vague about what counts as a major question, and it seems like whatever one of these conservative justices doesn't like is a major question. But that was just the beginning. What you're going to see this term is three or four cases that in different ways chip away at and try to use constitutional or legal theories to stop government from acting in ways that we have grown accustomed to government being able to act. And this goes back many years also. When FDR tried to expand the court packing fight, it was catastrophic for him politically, but the Supreme Court did back down and say that we're not going to use these theories to stop regulation anymore. We're going to let the government do its thing. And that's how the country grew. That's how we developed a modern country. And this was part of the progress of the country, but there was a handful of people who thought this was a great tragedy. They call it the Constitution in exile, and they want to go back to before 1937 and have the court block regulatory agencies, environmental protection. And it sounds like a kind of a fringy, kooky idea, but there was a New York Times article in 2003 that talked about it that said, well, there's one young judge named John Roberts. He seems to really like this, few years before he was appointed to the court. This is a long-term drive for him, for some of the others. And the challenge is, it's technical, it's arcane, it's not as vivid and dramatic as guns or abortion rights. But of course, if you care about climate change, then making an issue out of the capture of this institution, of the Supreme Court, by fossil fuel interests, by people who want to stop climate change regulation, but it's a political fight. We have to be able to explain it, not in legal terms alone, but in political terms, as they did back then. Teddy Roosevelt didn't just rail against the Supreme Court. He talked about the Lochner case, which was this case that was one of their regulatory cases. So I think it's a challenge, but I think that if people care about climate change, the greatest threat right now is not just the Congress or this lobby or that lobby, but the Supreme Court and those who follow it. I do think that there's a moment for optimism. The thing that gives me optimism right now and hope is that these issues are so hot and heavy. The issue of democracy and the shape of democracy and the health of democracy, poll after poll now shows it's a top voting issue for people. And not just hard left voters, but independents and Republicans, some Republicans as well. So the thing that people can do is vote about it, ask politicians, what are you going to do, as conservatives did for decades, say to Democrats, what are you going to do about the Supreme Court? What kind of judges do you want? What are you going to do to stand up on this stuff? There are specific reforms, as we discussed, like term limits. There is a movement that we at the Brennan Center have been very excited to try to help spur and foster. State courts are an independent bulwark for protection of rights and democracy and freedom. 49 of the 50 states have a stronger protection for voting rights in their state constitution than the U.S. Constitution does. They just haven't really enforced it. And this is true on a whole bunch of different things, including environmental protection. And so we need to say to people, you know, take these state courts seriously. And we had a conference the other day at the Brennan Center at NYU Law School. To our sort of astonishment, 300 people showed up and stayed for 2 days. Justice Goodwin Liu of California spoke and was a national leader on this. And it was you could just see the excitement of Republican and Democrat, 15 justices from courts, saying, you know, this is our moment to really stand up here. And so there's things like that. It's not going to be immediate. There needs to be patience as well as passion. Again, the people who fought for this version of the Second Amendment taught us that. And I think again and again, we have to go back to these core issues of democracy, of voting rights, of the structure of our government, and make sure that when politicians get elected, you know, President Biden, for example, says democracy is the issue, but what matters is not just that, but when people have power, are they going to actually enact things that uphold democracy and expand democracy and make the country's promise real? And so there's a democracy movement. We've all been sort of terrified by at least I have been, by the rise of the election denier movement. But now there's a democracy movement that is deep and wide and diverse. And that could be the story of the coming few years.
We've been around politics, campaigns, and in the Latino underperforms in terms of voter registration and voter turnout. And one of the issues is like, if you just try to talk to people, you should vote. Just sort of, you should vote. For a lot of people who are busy with their lives, that's just not a good enough reason. So how can, and it builds on a couple of questions, you know, does this moment, this Supreme Court, what it's done, what it's about to do, will it result in a fierce pushback from the left, from the center even? Now, and the other part of the question was, you know, how do we move the Supreme Court to the center even?
Right.
How do you make those legal issues, the Supreme Court, often its ivory tower, actually something that motivates people because it affects their lives?
Yeah, I think this is one of the great challenges. And as you know, in politics, so often the consultants tell the candidates, oh, nobody cares about this stuff. It's too arcane. People want kitchen table issues. They want stuff. They want things that tangibly affect their lives, and this doesn't. One thing I think that's true, and we've seen this in the last few years relating to Dobbs, people get particularly incensed when something is taken away from them. When they have an expectation, as people did on reproductive rights, and it's taken away, and when something can be done about it. So when you look at the electoral response to Dobbs, it was quite significant. As you know, the president's party usually does badly in the midterms, and a lot of the issues were really cutting against Biden. But because of Dobbs and fear over democracy, the Democrats had the best midterm election in decades for a president's party in power. But it wasn't universal across the country. In states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, places where they thought, oh, how I vote is going to determine whether we have abortion rights in my state or not, Wisconsin, it was determinative. In places like New York or California, where people kind of didn't really think it was going to be at risk, or Texas, where they didn't really have hope,
Right. Then
it wasn't such a voting issue. So I think it's the sense that something is being taken away and that you can do something about it. I think in terms of voting issues, it's often been the case that African-American voters who fought so hard through the civil rights movement and know that in places like Georgia and North Carolina, it's their rights that are being targeted more than anybody else, that's been a mobilizing issue. But again, because it's something that they have that's taken away or potentially being taken away. It's not kind of one might hope that aspiration for something good and new would motivate people enough, but people get really mad when something that they believe they fought for or that it's theirs or their right or the right as an American is taken away. So that, I think, can be a motivator.
Okay, one last. You spent some time talking about voting rights. And I think it's one of those issues where folks, they thought it was all settled. And what you describe reflects a sort of, like on so many issues, patience, slow, playing the long game. So both on voting rights, okay, you describe maybe state constitutions, state courts can step in. But do you believe the center left has the discipline to organize itself for the long haul? And how is the Brennan Center helping that?
It's a great question. And look, it's not just indiscipline. It's that we see a fight, we see an injustice, we want to rush in and do something about it. And sometimes you have to play that longer game. I think that one of the things that, again, we at the Brennan Center are encouraging, are pushing, are demanding, is that people in power focus on these structural institutional reforms to enhance democracy so the system works better when they have a chance to do something. So as you know, there's been considerable progress on this in that in the last Congress, not this current one, H.R. 1 and S. 1 was a broad democracy reform and voting rights bill that would set national standards on voting, ban gerrymandering, deal with dark money in politics, and restore the Voting Rights Act. And Speaker Pelosi was the champion of this in Congress when she was in that leadership position, and it came achingly close to passing. It passed the House, Biden wanted to sign it, it had a majority in the Senate, but as you know, two senators, Manchin and Sinema, didn't want to change the filibuster rules. Now every Democrat running for the Senate says, I will change the filibuster rules for voting rights. They need to not just give lip service to this, but when they have a chance, change the rules to make it so that the rules are more fair and empower more people. In the same way that a lot of the problems we've had have been the opposite. You're so right that when we were in the White House, voting rights was kind of for the history books. It was really a settled matter. In the first week or a couple of weeks, President Clinton signed the Motor Voter Bill. But after that, it was basically, compared to many other things, a settled matter, it seemed. It turns out that's not the case. We now know. But I think that insisting that people in power don't just lunge for the immediate deliverables, but to understand the significance of this stuff for the long term. I think that what we at the Brennan Center do, the role we try to play, is we are partly a think tank and partly a legal advocacy group and partly a communications hub. We believe very strongly that if you want to win in a court of law, if you want to win policy change, the court you have to win in is the court of public opinion. And this is something Lincoln said. He said, talking about slavery, in the first Lincoln-Douglas debate, he said, with public sentiment, anything is possible. Without public sentiment, nothing is possible. Therefore, those who mold public sentiment have more power than judges or legislators because they make it possible for them to do what they do. That's the kind of attitude I think we need to have about how to change the country. So we are trying to do our part. One thing I would encourage you all to do is we have newsletters that share our work every week. We now have 350,000 subscribers. They're very nutritious. There's no spam. There are lots of footnotes. but you can learn about what's going on in the fight for democracy. And you all have platforms. Everybody in this room and anybody watching in any other venue, we all have platforms that are much more vibrant than anybody ever had before. Spread the word on all the ways you communicate. And we can all make this work out, I hope.
So I know I have to ask this question because I think, and then we'll close, because you've got books to sign and sell.
Here.
Is your perspective on what do we do about the lack of young people involved in our democracy? We all know the information, you know, sort of the data. It's like, you're more likely to vote if you own a house. You're more likely to vote if you are highly educated and you're older. And so What is Brennan Center doing about reaching those young people?
I mean, we do our part in a whole bunch of different ways. We do, give you an example. We have a website, Brennan Center en Español, that is a full Spanish language website on all these issues and combating disinformation, which is very frequently targeted at non-English speaking communities and Spanish language communities. We see a tremendous interest in these issues in young people. They sometimes see the structural issues better than anyone else. They're just skeptical that anything can happen. And I do go back to the climate change issue. If people care about that, as they should, if it is seen as the existential threat, as I think it is, we're where we're at because of the distortion of American democracy. The Citizens United case, which was in 2010, which effectively deregulated money in politics. What impact did it have? The thing I always point to is, before 2010, the Republicans had a climate change bill. It was deregulation and other things, but they had a climate change bill. After 2010, they became the only major political party in the world to deny the existence of climate change. And that is because, with this new regime that was ushered in by the Supreme Court in that case, what they worry about is having dark money from the fossil fuel industry dumped into their primaries and defeating them. And the impact on the world is extraordinary. And so I would say to young people, you know what the problem is, and you can do something about it, and you know, vote yes, but organize. And see the connections in ways that the older people are too burned out sometimes to see.
We're a little tired. I want to say thank you on behalf of Berkeley and the Goldman School, and great conversation. And thank you to the audience.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.